From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump, very early on Friday morning, signed into law a massive spending bill that ended fears of another government shutdown and brought to a close a battle that began in December of last year. Despite Democratic lawmakers threatening to stymie any bill that did not have protections for undocumented youth, the bill passed with bipartisan support. The Senate voted 71-28, and just hours later, the House voted 240-186 to pass the bill. The bill boosts spending dramatically, much of it on the U.S. military. In fact, Trump boasted on Twitter on Friday morning, "Our military will now be stronger than ever before. We love and need our military," and gave them everything and more. Republican Senator Rand Paul angrily confronted his own party, saying, "How come you were against President Obama's deficits, and then how come you're for Republican deficits?" Meanwhile, the White House has been working to distance Trump from the stock market plunges over the past week. Reports suggested it was the worst week since October 2008. Trump has taken much credit for improvements in the economy. Will he take credit for the economy's failure too? My guest is Nomi Prinz. She's a former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Collusion: How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Her earlier books include All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliance That Drive American Power, and Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America. And she had a new piece in Tom Dispatch called Trump's Financial Arsonists, The Next Financial Crisis, Not If, But When. Welcome to the program, Nomi.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about the spending bill. This was signed into law early Friday morning. It ended months of battles. And essentially, it looks like the Republicans got what they wanted. Trump tried to make it seem as though the Democrats won some concessions and that he had to do that, or his party had to do that in order to get their support. But it seems as though this was a bill that the military can be very proud of, right?
Yeah, I think the military and the contractors that they engage will be very happy with this bill. It's a $300 billion increase in spending. And as you mentioned, yes, President Trump was against former President Obama's spending deficit. And yet he is fine with signing one bill that effectively increases the deficit for the military. And, I think there's a lot of, it's politics, so to say there's a lot of politics in Washington is obvious, but most of what's going on here is that he is true to his form, supporting things that he wants. And if they cost money, if they go into debt, this is a man whose empire was built upon not just debt, but bankruptcies. And this is just another indication of bringing that into the White House and just moving it forward for the rest of America, because that is basically how he has and is operating.
I wonder if hidden in the bill was financing for a grand military parade later this year.
It wasn't a line item, but that's this strange point about this. It's like you're. He talks about and talked about actually when he was campaigning our high debt and how that was crippling to America and so forth. He blamed other countries for it and our our sort of trade relationships and everything else for it. But the reality is you can't equate increasing military spending, bloating a budget, and also adding on potential money from outside or wherever for a military parade that we just don't need, and that's going to cost millions of dollars that could be best deployed literally in any other way.
Now, the deficit spending is something that gets very much politicized, often by Republicans when there is a Democratic president. Let's actually see what Senator Rand Paul had to say. I quoted him. He basically said he confronted lawmakers in the middle of the night. He said, "I want people to feel uncomfortable. I want them to have to answer people at home who said, how come you were against President Obama's deficits, and then how come you're for Republican deficits?" I guess you ought to hand it to Rand Paul for being consistent, one of the few Republicans for being consistent. But how come Republicans are okay with those deficits? And can you remind us whether there is really an issue with deficit spending, as Republicans usually like to claim there is?
Well, I think for the first part of that, the Republicans are okay with deficit spending for two reasons. One is that they really don't want to be caught not having a bill and having to be blamed for another government shutdown. That is sort of one thing. So coming up with a budget that even is an increase and that even will increase the deficit is something that also plays to what they anticipate, or people who are up for re-election anticipate, will help them in their campaigning. And you know, it is a strong core, both Republican and Democratic principle, actually, to fund the military and to have a strong military.
Right.
And so I think they feel that they can get away with equating a larger budget or increasing the deficit with strengthening the military, and that will actually play well in the upcoming election. So this wasn't really just about a budget, and it wasn't really just about what their opinions have been about deficit spending in the past. This was also very much about looking forward, I think, to the elections and determining what, if there was more spending for, would play well with their constituents, and military spending just does.
The New York Times explained the Democrats' support for the spending bill in this way. It said House Democrats, after threatening to bring the bill down because it did nothing to protect young undocumented immigrants, gave Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin the votes he did not have in his own party and ensured passage. And so definitely this is not just a Republican-owned bill. This is one that the Republicans couldn't have passed without Democratic support. Do you have any idea why there were Republicans that opposed it and what it was that ended up making Democrats cave into this, you know, after Nancy Pelosi's grand speech on the House floor for 8 hours reading Dreamers' testimonies?
Well, again, that goes to politics. The fear of not passing something was greater than the strength to fight for, on the Democratic side, more funding and more of solidity for the Dreamers. And on the Republican side, the Republicans that didn't vote for it, pretty much didn't vote for it along their general principle that we were discussing before, which is that it's simply more money. And it's like anything. It's like when you balance your own checkbook at home. You can decide to balance, or you can decide not to balance. And most of the Republicans who didn't vote for this bill simply didn't consider it appropriately balanced. Not that they would have necessarily balanced it away from the military and for Dreamers or for other sort of social programs, but just in general. That it was imbalanced.
Let's talk about what's happened to the stock market in the past week. This past Wednesday, Tuesday and Wednesday, we saw massive dips in the stock market, and then it bounced back up. Then Friday, it's back down again. Some are saying there's nothing to worry about. This is in the long term, the trend is part of sort of normal ups and downs, although it's a bigger down. Some are saying this is the market correcting itself. How do you, someone who has, had many years of experience in watching the financial market, how do you view what has happened and transpired in the stock market over this past week?
Well, what I think happened was the confluence of a movement in the Federal Reserve and a fear that the Federal Reserve would either raise rates or sort of taper their book of debt more quickly than the market wanted. And I think that's what sort of started the fear. There was a lot of reports about inflation growing and all sorts of things as around February 1st when the market started tanking, which is when I actually wrote that it wasn't a question of if but when. And that was a couple thousand points ago. And I think the way that that Wall Street sort of crowd and major corporations interpret the policy that has been in place since the last financial crisis is that the fact that interest rates have been so low, I mean, they've risen a little bit in the United States, but globally they've been predominantly on average at zero amongst the major countries and major country central bank policies. And inflation's been pretty low, and there has been a real supply of cheap money available to banks and therefore available to companies to issue more debt of themselves because they won't have to pay as much interest on it because rates are low, and use that money to buy their own stock and so forth. So the minute that the fear pervades the markets that that might stop or that might change, is when sort of that panic sets in. And I think that's what's really happened in the last few thousand points on the Dow, and including the biggest drop in the Dow historically in terms of actual points during the last week, is that fear. That money will not be as cheap as it has been for whatever the reason was very visceral and created a panic and created a sell. And then once there's a sell, then there's programmatic selling, and there's all sorts of levels that kick in from the standpoint of just electronically and sort of robotically and
even psychologically, right, to an extent.
make it worse. So that's really what happened. But also, what we had was a shift in the Federal Reserve chair position. We went to Jerome Powell from Janet Yellen. And in fact, when Janet Yellen left the Fed, she kind of turned around to media and said, oh, by the way, don't you think the stock market's a little overvalued? Which I think was a little bit of, well, here you go, Jerome Powell, who's taking my job. I'll just give you that. And of course, that could have had a little bit of a movement. But what it allowed was for Wall Street to take a look at Jerome Powell and say, look, we don't want you to raise rates. We don't want you to tighten money. And so there was also a bit of selling behavior that I believe was meant not necessarily one for one, but meant to give a message to the Fed, give a message to the new Fed chairman that it's really not okay to tighten money. And of course, then that took on a velocity of its own as the markets went down and then up and down throughout the week.
I mean, can you really blame Jerome Powell, who's literally been on the job, you know, very short amount of time, for any of this?
I'm blaming the institution of the Fed. Jerome Powell could be you or I, but the message to the head of the new Fed is we don't want our cheap money that we have basically grown accustomed to over the last 10 years. It's a warning to end. So if you or I were running the Fed, it would be the same thing. I'm not blaming Jerome Powell.
Right, right.
He hasn't done anything yet. He has indicated before coming in that he might want to tighten rates, but that has also been a forecast of the Fed that there would be 3 rate hikes this year. They also tightened last year. They tightened the year before. But if you add that on to reports about inflation slightly increasing, which it really kind of hasn't, but you know, that kind of took hold as well. And he's coming in. It's that message that banks, that Wall Street, that market participants, that speculators used to cheap money are providing to a new head who is the most powerful central banker in the world. He could be anyone, but he is Jerome Powell. And I believe it started subliminally or actually or some combination thereof of a message to this new Fed chair that we're not prepared yet to have a major change in policy. And again, then that took a velocity of its own. Because ultimately, these markets are not as high as they are due to any real growth, due to any real inflation, due to any real building, due to any real wages perforating throughout the consumer population and then buying stuff. It's really due to a decade-long policy of infusing the markets with cheap money, of quantitative easing, not just in the United States, but in Europe, in Japan, and so forth. And that has allowed a lot of capital to collect, find a home, pump the market up. It has allowed corporations to borrow cheaply and use that money to buy their own stock. Under Janet Yellen last year, there was a green light to the banking system to go and buy multiple billions of dollars worth of their own stock and raise their dividends to ask their investors to buy more of their own stock. These are all artificial pillars of the stock market. So again, and they are related to central banks. And so when things look like they're about to change, that sort of fake artificial type of rising, of bubble inflating of this market begins to deflate. There's just no there. And so that's where the instability comes in. And that's where we're now seeing these major swings as well.
So a massive bubble being pumped up artificially sounds like the last recession that ended up devastating the economy and countless American lives. It sounds like we're seeing the same conditions creep up into place again, which should not be surprising at all, right, Naomi? Because as you've pointed out many times, Not enough was done. In fact, just the most minimal amount of regulation was put into place after the last recession to prevent this from happening again. Nobody should be surprised if it happens again.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's right, Sonali. No one should be surprised. I mean, we're not surprised.
Can you get into the details of the Dodd-Frank, the fact that the Dodd-Frank is just not strong enough and that then we lost the Glass-Steagall Act?
No, that's correct. Dodd-Frank did not separate banks, their deposits and loans from their speculative activities. And it also, even though there was something in it called the Volcker Rule that's supposed to limit the types of more speculative trading that the banks are allowed to do and require them to put more capital behind them if they do them, there was a lot of loopholes in that and a lot of ways to get around that. I've written about that extensively as well. So what's happened is, in addition, this 10-year policy of lifting the markets and providing cheap capital to these banks. So it's actually, we're in a worse position now than we were going into the 2007-2008 crisis. There's actually more debt everywhere. It's sort of shifted from residential mortgage debt to more commercial mortgages, to corporates, to corporates in other countries and so forth, and also on public debt. There has been just a massive debt bubble because rates have been so cheap, because these central banks have bought assets kind of out of fabricated, electronically manufactured money that's been pushed into the market. And so we're actually at heights right now because they are so much more artificial than they were going into the 2007-2008 crisis, that the fall has the potential to be significantly larger. We're actually falling from a higher height. And so when that happens, it becomes actually more devastating. And we just saw in the last week that markets can give back a lot more in a day than they tend to rise. And that's historical. Panic tends to, and fear tends to, create more aggressive downside behavior when it's active than optimism creates upside behavior in an acute time period.
So the hallmarks are there, which is frightening. The last time the market crashed, we heard this rhetoric about the banks being too big to fail. And in fact, the government took great pains to help the banks rebuild, ensure that they didn't lose anything, and that in fact, they were able to capitalize on the recession to grow even bigger. What could we expect this time round in an increasingly consolidated and merged market with banks that are, I think, even bigger than they were before, right?
Well, they're bigger, and they just, they just lobbed in record profits at the end of last quarter. So they rebounded quite well, again, because they've had all this artificial help and all this central bank embracing and coddling. And so when you have another situation, and you can look at this over the past week, when a panic sets in, whether it's for a week or whether this is just a period of volatility we're going to see of chaotic sort of behavior on the way to potentially a bigger crash, the reality is what banks do in any of those instances is they hold their own capital very, very tightly. They protect themselves before they provide lending or before they provide financial assistance or restructuring of loans or whatever it is to their clients, to their customers. We see that in every crisis that, they sort of huddle for home. And that would definitely be what would happen in this situation, is that banks tighten on the capital they do have. And at some point, if things get really bad, they go back to the government or they go back to the Fed, and the Fed either stops raising rates, which I believe will happen anyway for now. I think the message is clear. There's expectations of a hike in March. I don't think that's going to happen. But they go back and they ask for more help. And again, they're doing that now from a higher height, from being bigger than they were before the last financial crisis.
So the banks are stronger than they were before, but the personal economy of a majority of Americans is probably weaker, given that wages did not rise back up and the jobs that were created were not secure enough. So wouldn't the impact of a crash this time around be even harder on a population that's already struggling?
Yeah, I mean, I think sadly it will. One of the reasons that, for example, people were voting as they did in the last election or expressing their dissatisfaction with the economy because of their own personal economies not feeling as strong as the market might have otherwise indicated they should feel, if that was the real barometer, which it isn't, of people's personal situations financially. So yes, if you have a prolonged stock market decline, and then you have also a bond market decline, meaning that companies aren't able to continue to furnish their interest payments on their debt, and they start to default, and they start to fire people, or they start to decrease wages or not increase benefits. I mean, all those things are wrapped up in that sort of protective mode that banks and then companies either go into because they have to, or they have no choice. So they want to, or they have to. And so it will be worse because, again, we've never really solidified economically much of the country. Wages haven't increased anywhere near the increase of the percentage in the stock market. People's savings, people's ability to live more than one paycheck to paycheck, I mean, all of that still exists. And so if you add into that another financial crisis, it bears more heavily on them personally, it bears more heavily on the companies that they work for, on the small businesses that they have that might have to be looking at cutting more employees and so forth. And then you have a worse problem than we had into the last financial crisis. Mm-hmm.
Naomi Prinz, let's talk about Donald Trump. Over the past year, any economic gains that he's been able to point to, he has been more than happy to take credit for. Even when he signed the spending bill on Friday morning, in addition to boasting about how the military was going to get even more than it asked for, he boasted jobs, jobs, jobs. I'm not sure how he got to that through the spending bill. But when the stock market briefly tanked, over this past week, the White House started to try to distance Trump from that particular marker. How much blame can we lay at Trump's feet, setting aside that he's probably taking credit for the good things that he doesn't deserve? How much credit would he get for the economy's failure, given that just in 1 year, he has really embarked on a very strong deregulatory program?
Well, I think His deregulatory program, both in corporate America and in the financial sector, as executed and ongoing executed by his sort of lieutenants in very solid regulatory positions, and the Treasury Department, now the head of the Fed, the SEC, the Consumer Financial Protection Board. He basically has individuals running all of these entities in Washington that are strongly advocates of deregulation rather than regulation of markets. And when you deregulate, for example, the banking system, you allow them to do whatever they want. The result is they tend to use money for speculative purposes to sort of pad their stocks, to pad their CEOs' pockets. I mean, all of those sort of things that happen. And to that extent, he can take some credit because, if they're able to believe that they will have less rules and they have the capital to deploy and markets aren't crashing at that particular moment, then they will do that and they will artificially increase the level of their stock prices, increase therefore the level of their compensations and so forth, and that pervades the market as it did going up. So it's not that Trump was actually, the reason that the stock market went up. The stock market was going up because of this sort of artificial stimulation throughout the system that went into the market, that went to the bond market and so forth. What he did, though, was indicate coming in that he was not going to change that, A, and B, was going to put people in place that would make it easier for that capital to be deployed however banks see fit. In that respect, he can take some credit for the rise, because as long as that panic that we just saw in the last week didn't set in, there was a lot of euphoria in the banking system about the fact that here was someone in office who, although he campaigned against Wall Street and against those sorts of maneuvers, actually is coming in and putting people in place that are specifically helping Wall Street. He can take credit for that. But that's not how he takes credit, right? I mean, he took credit by saying, well, it's growth, it's jobs, America's strong, that's why the stock market's up. So that he can't take credit for. But he can take credit for the fact that the concept of deregulation is something that banks like. Of course, when things turn sour, he pretty much backed off, the White House has backed off, and the market going down therefore has nothing to do with him. The reality is a market that's less controlled less regulated, financial institutions that are less regulated tend to do a lot of shady things on the way up as their stock rises in tandem. And those things tend to be discovered on the way down, and markets are just more punishing on the way down than they are sort of accepting on the way up.
So Trump's administration is filled with former CEOs of hedge funds and financial corporations that realize over the past 10 years, they are going to emerge from financial recessions relatively unscathed. So it behooves them to keep pushing deregulation since they don't bear a burden. Aren't they poised to make out like bandits even better than before, given their greater influence over our government? I mean, it's not just influence in our government, they're in the government now.
Yeah, they are the government, and they are our protectors, which is also scary. I mean, again, these people are in positions at the SEC, the Fed, so forth, that are supposed to be actually protecting the public and safeguarding, the sort of American population from the potential frauds or criminality or risky behavior of the financial institutions and corporate America in general, and them not doing that is, in their view. And moving towards more deregulation is, in their view, something that, again, unless things go wrong, can benefit their actual constituents, which are the banks and these other types of corporate institutions. And they do tend to leave and make a ton of money. Tim Geithner left to some private equity fund as the Treasury Secretary. I mean, he did okay. He was presiding at the New York Fed when the financial crisis started. He goes over to the Treasury Department. He does not actually push strong regulation of the banks. They do get bigger. Dodd-Frank is pushed, but it's not awesome. And he does fine at the end, because in the end, the relationship between the government and Wall Street is such that if Wall Street needs help, the government will provide it. We saw that in the wake of the last financial crisis, the Fed will provide it as well. And that will happen again. So ultimately, even if they leave and have a bad year or two, the upside is very high after that.
The Consumer Finance Protection Bureau was one government agency that was created in the wake of the last recession, championed by Elizabeth Warren, that was meant to protect consumers to some extent from the predatory behavior of banks in the wake of the next financial crisis. What can consumers expect in terms of protection from this bureau, given the Trump administration's, and the Republican Party's really open hostility towards this agency?
Well, this agency has basically just been defunded because Mulvaney, when he's acting
Mick Mulvaney,
as both,
yeah,
as both the head of the the Budget Committee in the White House, the OMB, and also the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Board, basically as one of his first moves this year, asked for there to be no funding for the Consumer Financial Protection Board. He's the guy that controls the budget, so or ultimately controls the execution of the budget. So that's a problem. It's a problem to the consumers, not just for protections going forward, but also the ones that have received monies due to them because of frauds committed against them by the financial system and by these banks. So there's things in play that will not be pushed forward, that will not come to fruition, that have been open sort of cases against institutions of retrieving settlement money, different kinds of money to the citizens that were wrong. So on the one hand, not funding and or having people leave and not replacing them or firing people or just decreasing the size of this agency hurts the consumers that are already being helped by it. And of course, it hurts consumers going forward, because it's just one less agency in Washington that was created in the wake of the financial crisis, in the wake of $160 billion worth of fines levied against just the top banks in this country for crimes they committed, basically against their consumers, the public, the markets, and as a consequence to that, for some reason, Mulvaney and the Republicans on the side of that don't seem to think that it's important to sort of not have that happen again. Hmm. It's really kind of bizarre. It's a total lack of understanding of what just happened leading into the financial crisis. What's happened even in the last 10 years is more levies have come out, as more settlements have had to be agreed upon. You know, you look at Wells Fargo and sort of its crimes against its own consumers, its own customers over the last year since the financial crisis. So, you know, it doesn't bode well to have someone running it who A, called it a joke before he got the position, and B, got the position and promptly began to defund it. So that's not a good thing. And usually, the sort of irony of all of this is that that Consumer Financial Protection Board is actually budgeted through the Federal Reserve. It was created in that manner through the Dodd-Frank Act and as Elizabeth Warren was working on it. And so the Federal Reserve technically is still supposed to be the sort of regulator of the banking system, the protector of the stability of the markets and of how they impact people, by acting as a watch group for the banks. And that institution, again, is head by someone who is pro-deregulation. None of this bodes well.
I mean, we're talking about the very, very high likelihood of the financial market crashing yet again, this time doing even worse damage to a population that's even less capable of, you know, being on the receiving end of it. And at the same time, even before this financial crisis hit, you're seeing so much suffering. There was a piece by Paul Waldman in the Washington Post recently explaining how Republicans want to turn the entire country into Oklahoma. And this is this interesting sort of news that's been coming out of Oklahoma, that the Oklahoma schools are now holding classes just 4 days a week because they simply cannot afford to have 5 days a week of school. Highway patrol officers were given a mileage limit because the state couldn't afford to put gas in their tanks. And Paul Waldman says that this is the direct result of very straightforward policies by the Republican-dominated legislature in that state that deregulated continually and cut social safety spending because, you know, they cut taxes, so they didn't have enough money to fund it. And they want to apply this model to states around the country that they control. So this is the sort of underlying project that they're engaged in as the stock market is getting more and more inflated and a bubble is getting ready to burst. It's just,
that's right.
It's frightening, Naomi. What the hell?
It's totally illogical. It was illogical when, you know, the Democrats also, you know, have done things sort of along this track. It doesn't make sense because if you're looking at just general prudency, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, whether you voted for Republicans or Democrats, the reality is, if you have a system whereby those that can impose the most risk on it are given the free pass to impose more risk, your system is just inherently not stable. And so it's not surprising that when things go wrong, or if there's a, you know, thought that things could go wrong in the future, that funding isn't available because it's been used to prop up the sort of risky system. I mean, in the case of sort of localities, relative to the fact that we have, you know, sort of record debt, and a lot of debt has been created both under Obama and under Trump to really sustain the markets where they are, by the fact that, you know, these other sort of places like schools that need money, you know, don't have the same access to it, which is tragic. That's an ongoing problem. It's not a prudent way of running a government. It's not a prudent way of running a business. You know, if you put any of these people, and you said you're going to have to use your own money to figure out how to run whatever business it is you're running and to make appropriate decisions, you are not going to just let money flow out without some sort of a culpability, without, you know, prudent regulations or rules for it, if it's your own. And that's how I think politicians should treat their own, you know, the country's money. They should treat it as if it's their own money. And that should be the thought that they have every single day when they go in and they look at a piece of legislation or they look at a potential piece of deregulation, is say, look, you know, if it were my money. Now, of course, a lot of them have a lot of money. It's not as much.
I was just going to say,
actually, one-to-one relationship with their money. That's how they should all be governing.
Yeah, I mean, the line between corporate money and lawmakers' personal economies is getting increasingly blurred, as we just said earlier. Nomi, you have a book coming out in the next few months called Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Unfortunately, that book might be beautifully timed to go along with a coming financial crash, or fortunately for you. What do you think the odds are, given what we've seen just this past week? Let's end on the question of, given what we've seen in the stock market in this past week, would you care to put make any kind of prediction about how soon before the bubble bursts?
I think it's there's bursting and there's deflating, and these are two different things. I think what we've seen in the past week is sort of air coming out of that bubble. We haven't seen that actual full-on crash like we saw with the 50% or whatever was retraction going into the early part of 2009 after the financial crisis. And that is because of the central bank help. There's $21 trillion of money that has effectively been fabricated and used throughout the world to buy mostly bonds, and in some cases stock, and in some cases equity, for example in Japan, to help keep markets up and to help the largest institutions get access to cheap money so they can help keep their own markets up, whether it's in bonds or whether that's in stocks. That's a very powerful 10-year policy, and the central bankers that have created it and have sort of stood by it don't really want to have to say at the end of the day the 10 years of stuff we just did was actually completely just smoke and mirrors kind of activities, and we said it would help the economy but really didn't because it's really not stable, or they'll blame something else or whatever it is they do. So there's a powerful other side here which can make markets more choppy than crash over the next couple months, so that we'll see these sort of big 500,000 point drops, and then we'll see 300, 600 point rises for a while, because on the other side of the fact that these are all artificially stimulated and they shouldn't be at these levels to begin with, and the fundamentals of the economy and the foundational economy hasn't been taken care of to the extent that these markets indicate, is this group of central bankers throughout the world who do have unlimited ability to infuse the markets with more sort of cheap money and lift them up. So that fight is going to continue to exist over the near future. So I think what we'll see more likely is these bigger swings. It's likely we end the year far lower than we started it. I mean, as we are now, but that there'll be up and down moments throughout this year because of that tension between these sort of powerful central bankers and the realities that the market is not buoyed by a sort of solid, strong set of growth figures.
So, Nomi, your book, Collusion, is out May 1st of this year. I know you're going to be doing an event for KPFK and probably having a speaking tour around the country. And it looks like it's going to be a hefty book, nearly 400 pages long. Is there a website you want to give out where people can find out more and see if they're coming, you might be coming to a place near them?
Thanks. Actually, my website has, there's lots of website picking this information. I tend to try and keep updated, which is just www.nomiprince.com. And you can basically look at pre-ordering the book through an independent store, sort of one of the main places that you may go to as a pre-order, and also where the events are. As you mentioned, May 5th, I'll be in LA. I think April 30th in New York, May 2nd, DC. But all of that's on the website as well.
Great. Well, we look forward to having you back on our program to specifically discuss the book. Good luck to you, Nomi, and thanks for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Nomi Prince. She's a former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers. Her forthcoming book out May 1st of this year is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Her earlier books include All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power, and Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America. And we'll link to her piece that she just posted in Tom Dispatch, just wrote for Tom Dispatch about the financial crash. And that particular article is entitled Trump's Financial Arsonists, The Next Financial Crisis, Not If, But When. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.